What's the impact of a healthy lifestyle on death?
Preventing emphysema exacerbations.
If you have to have coronary artery bypass grafting, what's the best blood vessel to use?
And tracking the prevalence of autism.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. This is posted on May 4th, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should start first with the one from Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, something from the CDC. It's taking a look at autism prevalence across the country.
It's a report and not a study. Now, granted, I think it really is important, and here's why. There hasn't been a consensus about how we diagnose autism spectrum disorders. So we've now developed new criteria. And secondly, it's not clear whether the increasing prevalence of autism is because it actually is on the increase, or we're identifying it early, or we've had changing definitions. So what this study attempted to do was look at the new criteria, what's called DSM-5. They looked at 11 different sites, ADDM sites, Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network, that have been evaluated since 2000. And they ask a couple questions. One is, what's the prevalence? Does the new criteria change the prevalence? And are there differences in terms of communities or in terms of racial prevalences? And what they discovered was, over the last 14 years, it appears that autism has increased in these 11 sites by about 150%. And these new diagnostic criteria aren't really the reason. In some populations, in some of these communities, as many as 3% of children can be diagnosed with autism before the age of 8. And that diagnosis is usually made between 4 and 5 years of age. Males are 4 times more likely than females to be identified with an autism spectrum disorder. It's more common in whites than it is in Africans, and more common in either of those than it is in the Hispanic population. And only about 44% of children with autism end up having average to above average IQs. That's IQs over 85. So this is an important landmark study. It certainly sets the benchmark and foundation going forward to see whether it increases in the future and whether early identification or treatment helps lower that prevalence.
I thought there was some data in here that they thought it had stabilized or even gone down in some populations.
Overall, it's increased, but it varies from populations from 13 per 1,000 kids to as many as 29 per 1,000 kids. In every one of these communities, it increased, but it increased from some as small as 10% to other communities as much as 30%, or 150% increases since 2000.
We also are not terribly good so far, at least as far as I can tell, with interventions.
No, Elizabeth, I think you're right. At this point, the reason to identify these kids early on is to be able to intervene to see whether it changes the outcome. So I agree with you.
More to come, I'm sure. Let's turn from here to another population study, really big study, in the journal Circulation. This was yet one more attempt, I have to say, to get our arms around what are the things, the factors that we have control over that can actually result in a healthier and a longer life. In this paper, they took data from the Nurses' Health Study and the Health Professional Study and identified our, no surprise, 5 low-risk lifestyle factors: never smoking, a reasonable body mass index, 30 minutes or more of moderate to vigorous physical activity daily, moderate alcohol intake, and a high diet quality score. Okay, so if you met all of these criteria, no surprise, it ended up really impacting on how long you lived. It's impressive here, of course, they had 34 years of follow-up. They estimated that life expectancy at age 50 years was an additional 29 years in women and 25, almost 26 years in men who had none, didn't adopt any of those risk factors. In contrast, those who did all 5 of them, for women at age 50 years, there would be an average of 43.1 additional years of life, and for men, almost 38 additional years of life.
If you adopt those 5 things, that your average life expectancy at age 50 is 14 years longer for women and a little over 12 years longer for men, as opposed to not adopting those. That is remarkable. What percentage of the U.S. population currently adopts those 5 lifestyles? You might be surprised and disappointed to know it's less than 10%.
Now, I'm going to ask you, because I've already said you're so intellectually honest and you read all of this data really intensely. Of those five low-risk lifestyle factors, which is the most important?
I looked at that in particular. All of them are additive, but it appears the one that makes the most difference happens to be smoking, followed by physical activity, and then about the same changes with regard to diet, alcohol consumption, and body mass index. Cigarette smoking, though, makes the biggest difference.
No surprise there, I don't think, but definitely worth reiterating that all of these are things that are under our control.
And Elizabeth, I think one of the things that most listeners will be surprised at is just as few as 1 to 4 cigarettes per day decreases the life expectancy in men and women by about 3 to 5 years.
On that note, you segue us very nicely into your next one. In the New England Journal of Medicine, what's the best strategy for managing that very common outcome of cigarette smoking, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD? 2 different strategies for managing that.
And there are 3 medications that are primarily used, all inhaled medications, by the way. One is a steroid, also called a glucocorticoid. There's what's called a long-acting muscarinic antagonist. I'm going to call it LAMA. And the third one is a long-acting beta agonist. We're going to call that LABA. And in general, people that have moderate to severe COPD or emphysema are prescribed a combination of these that are administered by a single inhaler. An inhaled steroid and a LABA, or a LAMA and a LABA, are the current recommendations. Well, now we have a single inhaler that incorporates all 3 of these medications. And the question is the use of this triple inhaler any better than the use of a dual therapy inhaler? And the answer is, yes, it seems to be beneficial. And they established that by looking at over 10,000 patients with COPD that had had exacerbations within the last year. And they randomized them to either triple therapy or 1 of 2 double therapies, dual therapies. When they followed these individuals over the course of a year, there was a significantly lower rate of exacerbations, and there was better lung function and also better health-related quality of life with triple therapy than with dual therapy.
There was something else in there about pneumonia. Would you describe some of the data relative to that?
It appears that with a slightly higher incidence of pneumonia in triple therapy than in dual therapy. It was a relatively minor increase in pneumonia, not severe pneumonia, but the diagnosis of it. But the benefits far outweighed, in my opinion, the small increased adverse events associated with it.
Well, I welcome, of course, the outcome of this study because having seen people hospitalized with acute exacerbations, we know that they can result in death.
Yes. And in fact, there was a hint that there was an improved mortality. Now we can get triple therapy in a single inhaler used once a day.
Let's stay now in the New England Journal of Medicine and talk about our last study for this week. I was really interested in this, and I'll tell you why in just a second. But this was, hey, should we use saphenous veins or radial arteries when we're going to revascularize somebody's heart, CABG, coronary artery bypass grafting? This is a meta-analysis where they took a look at a number of studies, and they had just over 1,000 patients included, about half in each group, one having received the radial artery graft and the other the saphenous vein graft. They took a look at 3 outcomes: death, myocardial infarction, or when they took a look at CT angiography, were we seeing that the graft was starting to close up again? And to me, not really a big surprise in this meta-analysis, they found out that the radial arteries were superior in everything except for death.
These were people that needed multiple bypass grafts. One of the bypass grafts that's routinely used is what's called putting the internal mammary artery on what's considered to be the major artery of the heart. That's the left anterior descending, or the LAD. So all of these individuals in both groups had that. But then when they needed additional bypass grafts during that same operation, did they use veins harvested from the leg, or did they use the radial artery harvested from the arm? Now you say, well, why didn't it actually improve death? I mean, it improved all 3 endpoints, but not really death. I think we've known for a long time that the most important bypass graft is the one that goes on the left anterior descending, the LAD. And every one of these patients had that done with an artery. Less important are the bypass grafts to the other vessels in terms of improving survival. And that's why it was beneficial in some respects, but there wasn't a big change in mortality.
One of the questions I have about this is, let's talk about harvesting the radial artery and what the morbidity is that's associated with that.
Elizabeth, the morbidity is not significant. The surgeons are very good at harvesting the radial artery, but it's only used in about 10% of operations currently in the United States. And the reason for that is because we really haven't had a large enough study proving its benefit. And by doing this meta-analysis, you get a large enough patients to say, hey, the radial artery is better than the saphenous vein graft, and we should be using it more often.
Important information. On that note, I'm going to talk about the autism prevalence this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.